tandem on March 25th, the questions concern the ability of the U.S. courts to control the disposition of detainees in the custody of U.S. forces or allied nations on other continents. And in Bismullah, the court is sitting on a petition filed by the Solicitor General seeking review of the D.C. Circuit's anticipatory rules for the conduct of military commissions. And if you think this is easy, this is the certiorari petition in Bismullah. The appendix to the petition is 250 pages long, and that's just the opinions of the D.C. Circuit and a few of the rules. So this turns out to be a fairly complex question. My task as moderator is to keep things moving. Each speaker will talk for 8 minutes for a presentation. We may have a brief response, and I hope that will leave time for questions from the floor. The Society may have asked me to be the moderator in the belief that speakers are more likely to obey a judge's directions to sit down. And that may be true of lawyers, but the panel has academics who think that the smallest unit of time is 50 minutes. So I will give some short introductions of the speakers in the order of their presentations and then get out of the way. Longer biographies are in your handout. Glenn Somazi is first, and he is a commander in the Coast Guard and a judge advocate. He's a professor of law at the Coast Guard Academy, so he combines teaching with practice. Earlier in life, he was a federal prosecutor, the executive officer on an icebreaker, and an aide to a member of Congress. He has written and lectured widely on national security law. Neil Kachal, who speaks second, is a professor of law at Georgetown, who engages in appellate litigation on the side. He represented the deans of many private law schools in Grutter against Bollinger, and more to the point, has represented Salim Hamdan in the Supreme Court, not only in Hamdan against Rumsfeld, but also in a brief amicus curiae filed in his terms in the Yen case. He, too, has written and lectured widely on national securities law. Joseph Margulies, our third speaker, is a professor of law at Northwestern University who engages in appellate litigation on the side. He represented Rasool in Rasool against Bush and is representing Omar and Yunaf in the cases now awaiting decision in the Supreme Court. He has written and lectured widely on national securities law. Do you see a pattern? Well, be prepared for a shock. Dean Ripkin, our fourth speaker, is not a professor of law and is not representing anyone at the Supreme Court this term. He's a partner at Baker and Hostetler, whose practice is principally in economic regulation, a subject that he's worked on as general counsel of the Department of Energy and at the White House during the administration of the first President Bush. But before he got into law, he was a defense and foreign policy analyst, and it's in that capacity that he will speak today. So, on with the show.
Thanks, Judge. Thank you, Judge, and thanks to the Federal Society of Chicago for having us all here tonight. It's really a great honor, and something that I think is terribly important, probably the seminal issue of our time, is what to do once we capture the detainees in the global war on Al-Qaeda. It really helps to define who we were, who we are, and who we'll be in the future. So our subject, basically, is why terror courts. To me, first and foremost, the military commissions, as they stand now, are de jure fine, particularly when viewed in a post-9/11 lens. We talked about this during dinner. We're at war with Al-Qaeda. We're capturing prisoners who were not uniformed, not signatories to Geneva. We're citizens of roughly approximately 50 nation-states and flouted the laws of war as doctrine. Also, often forgotten by many critics of the military commissions today, the administration was viewing intelligence reports that revealed incredible attacks in an operational mode about to be undertaken. Atrocities that we couldn't possibly imagine. The chatter was exceptional during this period of time. In fact, all of us, if we stop and think, back in September, October, November, December, January of 2001 and early 2002 were in a mindset that was quite different than we're in today, when the president and the administration were making the decisions to create the military commissions. Sears Tower we drove by, we're concerned about here. Bridges, government buildings, courthouses, malls, and even our schools. Again, the chatter was frightening, to say the least. It was in this context that the administration and the president issued the order of November 13th of 2001 authorizing military commissions. Prior to doing that, the staff looked and sought precedent, history, and they looked at the use of military commissions throughout our history and also statutorily, what were the statuses. They were, in fact, authorized by statute in the UCMJ. They were historically used by commanders in the field and presidents such as President Lincoln and indeed President Roosevelt. And the Supreme Court, in fact, in the Quirin case, which most of us know here, which was looked to by the administration, was authorized by President Roosevelt, including the detention, adjudication, and sentencing of at least six of the eight prisoners to execution within 2 months. This is the military commissions during that term in De Quirin were unanimously affirmed as lawful by the Supreme Court. Interesting to note, again, it was within 2 months in the Quirin case from capture, appeal, adjudication, and execution. 2 months, the period of time in which those saboteurs during the Second World War took place. But that was in 1942. Thus, to many, it seemed logical to use military commissions from this historical, statutory, and Supreme Court precedent analysis. But we know over time, the military commissions have morphed from that first decision in 2001. In 2002, the Department of Defense modified the order and provided more rights to the detainees. In 2003, when the orders were actually issued by the Department of Defense, there was considerably more process given to the detainees. It continued to evolve, as we know, and Neil knows very well, in the Hamdan case when the Supreme Court rejected the military commissions as they were structured. So the Congress got together in strong bipartisan fashion, passed what we have now today, the Military Commissions Act of 2006. So it continued to evolve. You see the steps moving forward, something towards maybe something new in the future. We know, having said that this is lawful and that the Military Commissions Act and the military commissions are lawful, as a matter of policy, they have not worked. That is a fact. As we've said before, many of us know, no prosecutions have occurred to date. Thus, now in 2008, it seems we need a new way to move this forward. We can't remain trapped in the two paradigms we continue to argue in, one using a law enforcement approach or an Article III approach to the detention and adjudication of the detainees, or the other way, the military, looking at strictly military commissions as the best means to detain and adjudicate these detainees. I would like to say, before going into that again, if I could, just for a moment, list a couple of the rights, though, that are guaranteed to the detainees right now in the Military Commissions Act. They're considerable, much more so than were granted, certainly, in 1942. The right to a full and fair trial, the right to know the charges against them as soon as possible, a presumption of innocence, right to counsel, government-funded defense counsels, opportunity to obtain witnesses, obligation of the government to disclose exculpatory evidence, the right to cross-examine, the right to not testify against oneself, limitations on the admission of hearsay evidence, ban on statements obtained by torture, limitations on statements obtained through coercion, focusing strictly on their reliability and probity, an assurance that we just saw in the last couple of days took place against General Hartman that no undue influence or coercion of a commission's self-referred members would occur. An assurance that the commission proceedings would be open, a presumption that they're open, and a right to, at a minimum, two appeals, and an assurance against double jeopardy. So interestingly, the criticism against the military commissions by law seems misplaced or at least engages in hyperbole frequently. Right now, from what I just described to you, that's more process than any prisoner of war would get in a time of war, a Geneva Convention war. But for some reason, we won't get into, or we may later, as a matter of policy and implementation, they haven't worked, and we need to find this new way to move forward. And certainly, military justice has evolved since 1942. More rights are guaranteed to our troops than ever before. Additionally, when we talk about closing Guantanamo, President Bush Secretary Rice, Secretary Gates, all three presidential candidates, and recently five former secretaries of state have all said it must close, not necessarily de jure, but as a matter of policy and the best way to move the country forward. So the suggestion is, again, what to do. It seems to me, if we look now at the Quirin model that the administration used, which again seemed logical at the time from the mindset we were in that period, the reason why it hasn't worked as well as one might think is that although this is a war, and I truly believe it is a war against al-Qaeda, it is a new type of war of the 21st century. The application of the Quirin standard in a conventional war between two nation states is not applicable in this war. What we have, truly, is a hybrid warrior, a mix of an international criminal and a warrior, not your normal standard warfare officer. In a hybrid conflict, it is a mix right now of law enforcement activities and warfare. So it would seem logical with a hybrid warrior in a hybrid war that it's logical to create a hybrid court, this mix of law enforcement and warfare. So again, as it continues to evolve, the military commissions, and we think that there's a way to move this forward, this military or terrorist court, national terrorist court, could be statutorily created. And I'll be brief as my time is limited. The biggest change would be in a national security court is it would be run by the Department of Justice, civilian oversight of the process. Brought to the military bases, a hybrid court would be run by the Department of Justice on military bases using the military brigs. Article 3 judges overseeing the cases. The prosecutors put forth by the Department of Justice from the National Security Division. The defense could still be provided by the JAGs, who are learned in these areas. But again, different and distinct from Professor Catchell's model, which he'll speak of shortly, mine is an adjudicatory system. I think it's incredibly important for us to try these people. Distinct from moving the preventative detention that's taking place on Guantanamo and just shifting it to the United States and saying, okay, we're going to shift things now and just and have these detainees held for the cessation of hostilities, I think the way to do it is to actually conduct ourselves in the best way possible and to adjudicate these crimes in national terrorist courts. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the members of the Chicago chapter for inviting me here. I grew up in Chicago, and so it's a wonderful thing to be back. And to thank Dean Reuter and the members of the National Society. I love speaking to your organization. I love what you stand for, debate, and the highest traditions of advocacy and fair-mindedness. And so I'm really delighted, again, to be here. Now, I have to apologize because I'm leaving at 6:45 because my criminal law exam is being given at 8 o'clock the next morning in D.C., so I'm catching the last flight out. So I will speak and then leave. I trust that everyone else will agree with everything I'm about to say.
Everyone else will caricaturize.
Exactly. So I want to speak to you about why I think a national security court is important and recognizing that the term is loaded in and of itself because it's itself rather empty. What is a national security court? It could mean a bunch of different things. It could mean prosecuting terrorists. It could mean preventative detention. It could mean any number of rights broadly or narrowly defined. And so because of that, the left criticizes that as saying, oh, it's indefinite detention. You're locking up thousands of people. The right say, oh, well, it's you know, it's not enough. You're going to be setting all these terrorists free, and so on. And so the devil undoubtedly is going to be in the details. And there's no way in 7.2 minutes that I can detail exactly what my proposed system would look like. So what I want to do is actually just convince you that there's a need to do something in this sphere and that we can't just leave it to the courts, which is what we've been content doing for the past several years with this really difficult set of issues. So obviously after 9/11 we captured thousands of people, some of them suspected terrorists, some of them very serious bad people. And the administration basically did two things. Number one, they set up, as Glenn said, a trial system for military commissions in which they planned on trying 70 or 80 people down at Guantanamo. And second, an indefinite detention of these people, of the remaining hundreds of people that they brought to Guantanamo Bay. Now, I understand Glenn's remarks. He says, you know, there's a big threat and, you know, the administration did what it had to. And, you know, if you look back in time, we were all scared and so on. But a lot of us at that time said, this isn't the right way as a matter of process to go about a system. Because what you're doing is basically you're saying the president can do all this on his own, and when you think back to what our Constitution was all about, you think back to those words in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that separated and divided power precisely because, as Madison said, men weren't angels, the system did look rather suspect. And, you know, as a student of history, you think about the Supreme Court in a role of wartime. You look back over all of the war cases that have come to the court. It's really hard if you're the commander-in-chief in wartime to lose a case in the Supreme Court. You kind of have to try. It's kind of like failing a class at Yale or something like that. But here, the administration's managed to do it four times. You know, they said no rights for U.S. citizens that is labeled enemy combatants. Supreme Court said no in the Hamdi case. That was wrong. They said no Geneva Convention rights. Supreme Court said no. That was wrong in 2006. They said we could set up military commissions on our own. The Supreme Court said wrong in 2006. They said no habeas rights as a matter of statute for Guantanamo detainees. They said no, that was wrong in 2004. And now the Supreme Court's facing yet again another case, the mentioned Bamidian case, about habeas corpus rights as a matter of constitutional law for the Guantanamo detainees. And I dare say that I predict that the administration will be found in error once again. This is not a workable model for government. Instead, we need the legislature and the president to think seriously about how to do this in the future. We are behind the veil of ignorance. We don't know who the next president is. Strikes me as this is a very good time to think about this as a matter of long-term looking forward. What should we be doing? Because we can't just simply leave it up to the courts, generalist courts, who are trying to micromanage the process. I mean, you look at the Hamdi decision, and you have Justice O'Connor's plurality, you know, using the Matthews versus Eldridge due process balancing test from 1976 for, you know, I mean, to try and deal with the modern threat of terrorism. That strikes me as a very dangerous place for our country to be. And you think about, again, what our country was based on and the primacy given to the political branches. That's where the solutions should originate from. And it starts with people sitting down and taking reasonable positions on both sides and not taking extreme views. So the president can do whatever he wants or the president can do none of what he wants. So with that in mind, that's what I think the National Security Court would be looking to and examining, what proposals should look to and examine. I think that it is not possible to prosecute everyone criminally. And those who think that it is, I think, haven't dealt with the real difficulty in foreign prosecutions in general. And then when you think about intelligence and sources and methods and the number of other complexities that are going to take place from gray mail and the like, I think that there will be some cases in which prosecution is impossible. And so there will need to be some sort of detention system that will be in place for those people who can't be prosecuted criminally. How large that is or narrow, I think obviously the great way, as Glenn says, should be prosecute wherever you can, because trying people is the American way of doing things. At the same time, the laws of war recognize that when someone is truly an enemy combatant, you can detain them, and you can detain them until the end of hostilities. So we need a process in place to make sure we got the right people down there. And I don't know if it's necessarily constitutionally compelled. I don't want to get into that whole debate over whether the Constitution requires a great process. But as a matter of policy, you look at the enmity around the world, you look at those noted liberals, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense, who are saying, close Guantanamo, it's actually harming our national security. What I think they're saying is we need a process in place as a matter of policy, even regardless of the Constitution. What would that policy look like from my perspective in 2 minutes? Well, the first thing is that I think federal judges would oversee it. Judges like Judge Easterbrook over here who deal with cases on a daily basis. I think that it would not have the same standards of evidence as an Article III criminal trial in every circumstance. There can be looser standards and some looser set of rights because we are only talking about detention, and the detention will be reviewed every 6 months. It wouldn't be indefinite, but we are only talking about detention. We're not talking about criminal prosecution. Our Bill of Rights, after all, half of it deals with the special rights that are given to you as a criminal defendant. If you're facing simply detention, I don't think the same full panoply of rights adhere to you, but obviously many do. two preconditions for what I think this National Security Court would be. Number one, it would be set up by the legislature. And number two, it would apply equally to United States citizens and foreigners. That is, I think that the only way to insist to get a good political process in place is to make sure that the rules that apply to terrorists around the world apply to our own terrorists. And I don't see any reason why, if a Timothy McVeigh does an attack on us, that it should be treated any differently than someone who's a green card holder or someone who is a foreigner. It's the same crime, should get the same punishment or the same detention regime. Thank you very much.
Good evening. I also want to thank the Federalist Society, and I will say this. I have never seen a Federalist Society event, either in law school or in a setting like this, that didn't make an assiduous effort at balance. And I commend the organization for that. They are invariably informative and literally bend over backwards to try to be representative of views. I want to try to. I oppose the idea of national security courts as I understand them. Let me just state myself, put that out there to begin with, as I understand them. One of the reasons I characterize my answer that way, or my position that way, is because, as Neil says, and he's certainly right, the devil will be in the details. But at this point, we are trying to hit a moving target. Until we see what it is that people are proposing, it's difficult to frame a set of objections. That is particularly the case with respect to any constitutional objections one might make. I understand, I believe that my friend Mr. Rifkin is going to state some of his constitutional concerns with it. I will leave those aside and speak to policy positions, because it's impossible to critique the constitutionality of a bill you don't see. I also want to address now what concerns me as some of the a very serious problem of overbreath in some of the discussion. If the but the question is to whom this universe of people is applied, to whom this paradigm is applied. If it is designed to replace the entire enemy combatant paradigm, so that is anybody who's picked up and brought to Guantanamo Bay or now held at Bagram Air Base, the majority of people, as you probably know, are no longer brought to Guantanamo Bay. The prison at Bagram is now substantially larger than the one at Guantanamo. If that is the idea, that we will use this to replace the entire enemy combatant paradigm, which according to the administration can sweep in thousands of people from anywhere in the world and so on, then it is substantially overbroad. My concern is that it is substantially more broad than it needs to be, because even the administration doesn't say that those people are, the majority of those people, are suspected of terrorist activity. So if we say that the position is that we are looking for alternatives only for people who are suspected of terrorist activity, that is, people who would otherwise ordinarily be subjected to trial, either in an Article III court or in a military commission, that's the universe of people that we're talking about, because they have committed some crime or terrorist act, and but for perceived deficiencies in an Article III court or a military commission, would be tried in that setting. But because we think there is some difficulty with bringing that person to trial there, we can. That's the hypothesis that drives this discussion. That's the universe of people that I want to address now. If it's just for all the sort of the routine, you know, a guy who was affiliated with the Taliban in some capacity or alleged to be, and we want to devise a separate court for him, I'm strongly opposed to that, because by hypothesis, that person is not engaged in or even alleged to be engaged in any terrorist activity. Should not be taken out of a law of war paradigm. All right. So let's assume that we're talking only about people who would otherwise be tried, but because of some perceived deficiency in the Article III or military commission system, we feel you cannot try them. What is the wisdom, what is the utility of creating a new set of courts for that small universe of people? Let's talk about the size of that group, by the way. So far, Neil says that maybe there would be 70 or 80 at Guantanamo who are there. As we know, none of these trials have gone forward yet. there are about a baker's dozen worth of people who have been identified as candidates for them. So after 7 years, we have a universe of approximately 13, 15, maybe there's 20 that they have in mind, who knows. But we're talking about a small set of people. All right. I have two objections, and let me leave aside for now what I would call the second-order objections to this. And one is just what is it that the court, I mean, think about this as practitioners. What is it that such a court says? What is it that it concludes? Does this court say at the end of it, you are guilty? That is it a prosecution for a crime that's in the books? Or does it say something else? Does it say you are a terrorist, this new category that we define, that we have to define statutorily, or does it use a pre-existing category, a statutory definition for terrorist, and therefore we can hold you forever? The question, these second-order questions of just what exactly the court concludes are exceedingly important because in our system, the body of jurisprudence develops with an eye to and as a consequence of the legal category that someone is being put into. So you've got to answer those questions before you can answer other questions about allocation of burden and how such a case would go forward, what due process rights. All right, but leaving aside those, what I call second-order problems, I have two fundamental objections. The first is that the problem with this position is that there is no convincing showing that I have seen of need. It has not been demonstrated to me that there is a need, that the Article III or military process is inherently incapable of handling these cases. And in fact, we know that the Article III process is robust and effective. And there has never been an unsuccessful terrorist prosecution. And the Southern District of New York developed an extraordinary expertise in bringing these cases successfully, the First World Trade Center cases and the embassy bombing cases. In fact, one of the people identified as a candidate for prosecution at Guantanamo is a guy named Galfani, and he is a potential capital case. And Mr. Galfani is a particularly important case. He was just recently named as a candidate for prosecution because he is charged, or will be charged, in the embassy bombing in Tanzania, which took place in 1998. And why is that especially significant? Because the purported justification for these special trials is that Article III courts can't handle these cases. But of course, as this group knows, Mr. Galfani's co-defendants were prosecuted in an Article III court. They were prosecuted successfully and convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment in the Southern District of New York, one of whom was alleged to be a participant in the Tanzania bomb. The second, and I will leave it at this, is that there is no showing yet that I have seen that the universe of potential candidates for this court exists. That is, it strikes me as an analog to the ticking time bomb scenario. In the same way that the ticking time bomb scenario captured and hijacked the torture discussion by hypothesizing the existence of a person who so fundamentally altered the terms of the debate because the potential consequences were so grave, but whose actual existence could never be shown, that this person who is hypothesized to exist and is incapable of being prosecuted in the normal system, until that showing is made, it seems to me, and I have entertained all the hypotheticals that I can identify and that others have put to me, and I welcome this group to put to me, it doesn't seem to me evident that the existing system fails to reach that person. So I have other objections as well, but leaving it at just those two, that would be my concern.
Well, let me I find myself somewhere between, among the previous three speakers. I'm not a big fan of counterterrorism court, in part because I don't think you would succeed in curing some of the problems that the application of military justice paradigm has revealed, and also because I do have some fundamental problems, both institutional and legal, with a preventive detention regime. But let me say first, contrary to what you heard from my good friend Neil,
I don't think that the administration's legal paradigm, which, let's be honest, is anchored in traditional laws and customs of war, and in my view is eminently legal, isn't that much trouble. It's the classical glass half full versus glass half empty issue. If you look at the actual holdings of Hamdan and Rasul and Hamdi, unless the Supreme Court does something incredibly foolish in Boumediene, and I've actually predicted that they would not, and I think they do quite well in Omar and Muna, the military, from a purely legal perspective, the military justice paradigm, which now consists of sort of two primary institutions, the military commissions, which I'll speak briefly in a second, and the whole detention system where people are not going to be tried in military commissions, frankly speaking, there's not enough evidence done for something called CSERTs, combatant status review tribunals, is kind of creaking along reasonably well. Could be doing better, but frankly, a lot of it, some mistakes by the administration, but also the relentless attack by folks who don't believe the proposition that this is real war and laws of war apply. And so there's a lot of ideological, almost Talmudic elements in this whole debate. But let me say briefly this. It is the detention regime that has proven to be most difficult for combatant status review tribunals, and it's something we ought to fix. By the way, it's not just Guantanamo, ladies and gentlemen. We have literally thousands of people, not innocent shepherds, not humanitarian aid workers, but hardened members of Al-Qaeda, currently detained, over 2,000 from what I've heard, places like Iraq. The reason they're detained there is because they're not being brought to Guantanamo, in part because of institutional bureaucratic infighting about the status of Guantanamo, in part because the Supreme Court is likely to have a somewhat different legal regime in Guantanamo than its special status than elsewhere in the world. So it's not just the 280 folks in Gitmo, it's people in the background, while the current style of combat in Iraq goes on, it is not that huge of a problem. But I can envision some circumstances where the future Iraqi government would not be interested in dealing with this body of people. The most attractive aspect that people have suggested is you have this new court have preventive detention regime overseen by the judges. I don't think it's going to fly for really two sets of reasons. One is constitutional. There are people, including my good friend Ben Wittes, who's written probably most eloquently about this, who look at the different strands of preventive detention regime that includes criminally insane individuals with highly infectious diseases, some individuals who are in removal proceedings. Lavitas would be a perfect example of that type of a situation. That's the name of a Supreme Court case. Et cetera, et cetera. And then they basically say, look, the American body politic has tolerated situations where these aspects of a preventive detention regime have been approved. We can extrapolate from that, sort of massage it, and come up with a broader preventive detention regime overseen by the judges. I happen to think that these cases are all different strands of cases. I don't really see a cogent constitutional basis for coming up with a broader preventive detention regime. But even if I'm wrong, I'm able to be wrong. I just don't see, frankly, not this life judiciary institution, I just don't see judges be willing to essentially oversee / rubber stamp. Let's face it, talk about a definite detention. If we're not talking about detention of enemy combatants who would be detained for creation of hostilities, we really are talking about a definite detention. If you look at the situation in Israel, for example, speaking frankly, you have every 6 months review by Israeli courts, but not many people get out. The people who get out are released as part of various prisoner exchanges. But I mean, I just don't see many Americans, and again, to be somewhat cynical, the judges would bear all the burdens here because you would not have psychiatrists telling them this person is criminally insane. You would not have MDs telling them the person bears infectious disease. And you would not have somebody from the State Department saying we cannot send some of the people, Fidel Castro, dumped on our shores back to Cuba for the following diplomatic reasons. They would, in fact, have to hold people I know it's not meant to be punitive, et cetera, purely as a threat to public safety. Well, let's be honest, on the basis of factual evidence that is utterly insufficient by any standards of criminal justice, the reason it's insufficient, again, is not because they're innocent shepherds, it's because when you capture somebody in the battlefield and you try to bring physical evidence for it, or the reason this person's association is because of what, Egyptian intelligence officer told you heard from, you know, the Jordanian asset, it's just not going to fly. So once you take the preventive detention off the table, I'm not sure what the new court is supposed to do. Military commissions are finally getting to the point where they're going to do their job and do it well. They're under relentless attack. I've never seen in sort of my lifetime an effort to not just prove an individual parties are innocent, but just completely destroy the institution. But I think they're going to survive. And one of the things I wanted you all to know, and be happy to be challenged at this point, if you look at the breadth of charges that have been brought against the new so far, against the 9/11 folks in military commissions, because of a double jeopardy problem, I believe, or happen to believe, that none of those people can be reindicted because they've all been effectively arraigned. And double jeopardy attaches at the arraignment stage. So if we suddenly shut down the military commission process, warts and all, and try to create a new system, in effect, people like KSM and Ramzi Belarusi would be unable to be prosecuted. So I think the best we can do is to work with a system that we have and not buy into the proposition that there's some heroic answers. And my only hope, I'll stop at that, is that once we do get through the first set of military commission trials, it would imbue somewhat of additional legitimacy in the system that it is lacking right now. Thank you.
Thank you. We have an opportunity for a brief interchange among the panel members. Although I will say one thing based on my time in the Solicitor General's office. As I understand the federal rule on double jeopardy, jeopardy attaches when the jury is sworn, not when someone is arraigned, and therefore since there are no juries in the military commissions, there would be no double jeopardy problem. But that may be wrong. We'll open it up to the panel members to have brief comments on each other's presentations, but I hope perhaps you will use this as an opportunity to talk about the missing tribunal. There have been discussions so far about the military commissions, about the Article III courts, about a specialized court staffed by Article III judges, specialized court perhaps not staffed by Article III judges. The missing tribunal is the military court-martial. One might think that a good option for dealing with people who violate the laws of war is a court-martial, or a standard court-martial. So perhaps our panel members will say a few words about whether they think that is appropriate or why. If not, it is inappropriate.
Thanks very much, Judge. I don't think courts-martials are appropriate. A courts-martial was never intended for carrying out these items. In fact, from George Washington's time and including the enactment of the UCMJ, the Congress also saw the military commissions as being distinct for and to be used against illegal belligerents. They had been used, they've been used that way, and so the Bible of any JAGs in the room or military officers know the Bible for military laws is the manual for courts martial, and the UCMJ provides specifically in there the proper venue for conducting these sorts of trials against illegal belligerents. Or now what we call enemy combatants, is the military commission. So I think that's one level. The second level is, to a large degree, the military courts-martial, the rules of evidence, are roughly analogous to the federal rules of evidence, as you know, Judge. And in so doing, a lot of my concerns with trying these cases, or Neil's concerns about trying these cases in civil courts, would be, again, brought to pass within a military courts-martial. And then lastly, as an active duty member, and again, I'm here in my private capacity, I should have said that up front, but as a military member, I can say most sincerely, it's almost insulting to think that we would use the same system against illegal belligerents that you would use against those of us who are troops and those of us who might get into trouble while serving the armed forces. It's there for our own U.S. armed forces, not for the British armed forces, not for the German armed forces, but simply for the U.S. armed forces. And it's our system of justice, not one to be used against someone who might have less protections or expect less protections under the laws of war, under any statutory regime.
Thank you. In some sense, my good friend Glenn stole my thunder. I've been one of a few people who've been fairly emotional about the proposition that choosing the right legal paradigm, which is not just, as we all know, it's not just the substantive body of norms, ladies and gentlemen, but also institutions and procedures is enormously important, because the way society deals with various types of problems isn't just only animated by the desire to render justice to the accused. It also tells you how society feels about certain types of issues. That's why there's fundamental differences in a criminal adjudication drawing upon the laws of the criminal justice paradigm is distinct from the military one. And Glenn, of course, explained the business of unlawful combatants, again, not to dwell on it, enemies of humanity and all this other stuff. But if you look at the very briefly at the laws of war, for centuries, they were driven by a desire to stigmatize, delegitimize unlawful combatants, because by definition, they can do nothing right. In many respects, it's a status offense. I know where as lawyers I'm comfortable with status offense. Lawful combatants, when they violate laws of war on an individual basis, ought to be prosecuted and punished quite harshly for it. But unlawful combatants are never right. And they used to be treated very, very harshly. They got more civilized, they got due process. One of my favorite examples is the first unlawful combatant proceeding in American history involved Major Andre. And it was tried by a military commission presided by George Washington. So an officer and a gentleman just happened to be caught, actually robbed, but one time again into history. Basically, a couple of soldiers from the Continental Army robbed him, took his boots off, and found the documents relating to negotiations over West Point. He was an officer and a gentleman. The best he got after a military commission trial, he was shot instead of being hung, because it just was not something you did. And it's enormously essential, especially in this day and age, when so many of our friends and allies don't appreciate the proposition this is war, not just a terrorism problem, that so much of the international community wants to vitiate the differences between lawful and unlawful combatants. And for symbolic legitimacy and permanent reason, we sort of stick with it. Frankly, the differences between military commissions and court-martials under the MCA, one thing, I don't want to jump to Professor Mattel, especially since he's not here to defend himself, but the notion the president is doing things in his own authority now is bunk. Military Commissions Act, passed by Congress and October 2006 is a piece of legislation. They like it, dislike it. It will be no different than legislation creating a counterterrorism court. So both political branches spoke in unison, and they created military commissions and rejigged a few other things. So I think that Article 3 courts don't work. The counterterrorism court, there would be some permutation on existing Article 3 trial courts would not work well. I don't think court martial would work. I think we have to stick with the system we got, warts and all, and do the best we can.
Because I want to engage you all, I'll be very brief here. It is simply empirically incorrect to say that Article 3 courts do not work. Article 3 courts do and have worked, and are working as we speak. Whatever illegitimacy we attach to the act of blowing up a building, blowing up multiple buildings, it is also a crime. And the response in the past has been to treat those people as criminals, as thugs, which is what they are. And they have been successfully prosecuted, very successfully. There are places where the military operates in a traditional theater of operations and under traditional paradigms. And in that, those places, historically, traditionally, dating back to common law, the criminal law does not reach. That doesn't mean you have a lawless void. What you have is prosecutions based on the laws of war. Now, whether that law of war is given to you by a military commission model or the UCMJ is less important to me than that, first of all, that it be properly cabined to its legitimate scope, and that it be sufficiently robust to serve the purposes of the laws of war. We happen to disagree about whether the Military Commissions Act does that for the universe of cases that may come before it, but the more important thing is that you not eliminate the barriers between law of war and criminal law cases. That's all.
Can I just get 10 seconds of observation? Because obviously failed when I talk about legitimacy. Yes, unlawful combatants are also all criminals, but they're different kind of criminals. they've always been viewed as far more dangerous criminals than ordinary run-of-the-mill terrorists. And it is that distinction that would be missing if we were to abandon this unique system for dealing with unlawful enemy combatants as distinct from the community, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying they're not criminals.
But before we open it up to the floor, I'll exercise the chairman's prerogative. Just ask one question of Professor McHugh. When you say that standard prosecutions have worked, the question is, what are the criteria? I completely understand the point that the Southern District of New York has been uniformly successful in the prosecutions it has brought. The question is, do we know which cases might be prosecuted before a military commission or a specialized tribunal of some sort that have not been filed in the Southern District of New York or elsewhere, that is, have not been brought at all? Because given the rules of evidence and the jury system and the prospect of gray mail, you all know what gray mail is. It's basically, if you prosecute me, in order to introduce the evidence you need to convict me, requires disclosure of national secrets that are more important than convicting me. And therefore, the prosecutor does not introduce certain evidence or doesn't bring certain cases at all. But, so do we know what the terms of trade are? All the cases that get brought have succeeded. Do we know what the set of cases that haven't been brought because of the peculiarities of the Article III system? Do we know what's in that set?
Yeah, the answer is no. Or at least, if we know, I do not know.
Certainly don't know.
Right. And of course, there is at some level, I recognize that that's a legitimate question. It is impossible to respond to because that universe will never be identified. So, because they'll say.
Except by somebody who's in breach of some secrecy agreement that he signed.
Right, precisely.
If there's anybody like that in the room, please step forward.
You promised to turn off the microphone. We do know, however, that there are cases that have been modified in order to allow them to be prosecuted so as not to avoid. So, for instance, the most obvious one is Padilla, who was successfully prosecuted, and they took certain parts out of the case that the government still maintains it had, but in order to successfully prosecute them, they made certain compromises. That is routine. It also happened in the Abu Ali case, which was a guy who had been in Saudi custody. He was brought here and prosecuted in the Eastern District of Virginia. There was a dispute that happens all the time over the admission of classified information. The government said, if you want to use it, you've got to disclose it to the defense. The government therefore said, then we won't use it. The prosecution went forward. He was convicted and sentenced to, memory is, 37 years. Routine. It happens all the time. But are there 26 cases out there that they would have brought? I don't know.
Can I just add one point? It's interesting. Just from the flip side of this argument is this. Let's not talk about cases that get brought. Let's look at the costs of cases brought. I certainly, the Justice Department has never criminal prosecutors, so I'm only benefiting from the wisdom of my friends and colleagues, people ranging from Attorney General Casey, who, of course, was the presiding judge of probably the most successful and important criminal prosecution, to Andy McCarthy, who was the prosecutor, all uniformly have written over years describing the huge, the huge cost of these cases, you know, ranging from the, what you undoubtedly have heard, the business about a certain ability to intercept satellite routed phone calls, you know, cell phones, which would you import that information, we know, because we've actually seen Bin Laden's notes in his immediate sort of possession, got transmitted to him in Sudan. This is all came up after, of course, we did, again, take him down in Afghanistan. This huge cost that the government did bear, but let's be honest, just because the government did bear it doesn't mean there's not cost. But most importantly, and this is my problem with what Joseph was saying, work in what sense? Prosecuting somebody does not mean operating in a way that stops future attacks. And that, to me, again, if you look at this, is not as an exercise of just rendering justice to individual defendants, but a broad exercise of protecting our body polity. It sure like heck didn't work, because after World War Trade Center bombing one, we got two. So it most certainly didn't work by that standard.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's time for questions from the floor, although I can't resist observing that the costs of these prosecutions have been enormous. The the World Trade Center bombing case just went on for an enormous length of time and kicked out a lot of bank robbery and financial fraud prosecutions. But I have a sense that there are too many U.S. attorneys' offices who over-prosecute even routine political bribery cases. There's been a case in Chicago against Tony Rezko that's gone on now for 4 months, and it's just a routine bribery case. One wonders whether there shouldn't be a rule. I'm, alas, not at the moment in the position to write it, that if the prosecutor can't complete its case in 1 week, the case will not be allowed to proceed. All right, we are open for questions from the floor. Please stand up, state your name, and state your question. Need I repeat? State your question. This differs from a statement with an interrogatory inflection of voice at the end. And please identify who you're asking the question of.
Mr. Ripken, I think it is, among others. If you don't have a federal crime to get into federal courts, and you don't have jurisdiction under UCMJ, and you have a non-combatant, so you don't come under the Geneva Convention, don't you automatically then have to turn to a commission?
Well, it's there's a lot of sort of semantic differences. First of all, UCMJ, with all due respect to Joseph, the notion that UCMJ does not recognize the existence of military commissions and the body of law that deals with lawful commands, it just put it bluntly ain't so. The UCMJ rules don't deal with it, but UCMJ acknowledges, point number one. Point number two, we do have federal crimes here, just not in the form of a civilian criminal justice system, but these are certainly offenses against the laws of war. And the other thing is, again, I'm fairly passionate about it. Geneva Conventions of 1949 is not the alpha and omega of the laws of war. They're just one bit of it. To use an example from an area that dear and near to my heart, they're not even the Clean Air Act amendments relative to the body of environmental law. They're, you know, one subset of the Clean Air Act amendments. So the notion that if something is not a Geneva Convention, it's just not out there is just respectful, not true. It happens, but unlawful combatancy is governed by rules that are primarily a matter of custom because nobody ever had any occasion to pass a convention. And if we had more time, I can explain how what happened in the Geneva Convention of 49 versus The Hague versus Geneva 26, how this whole iterative process worked. It's all an international law. It's of equal validity and legitimacy as the provisions of 49 conventions. There's nothing new about it. It didn't get invented by Dick Cheney or W. Bush. This stuff goes back to the 1500s, the unlawful, original unlawful belligerents were a bunch of condottieri fighting on their own behalf in addition to fighting on behalf of various Italian city-states. There's nothing new about this.
This question is for Professor McGillis. I don't know if I pronounced your name right.
It's okay.
In terms of your faith in the art of three courts and how they, in your mind, is successful, would you recognize, or do you, how would you address the inherent conflict between when you apprehend someone in a crime and the interrogation of the crime in terms of figuring out whether they committed the crime and providing them random warnings and things like that, versus given the war on terrorism and the importance of intelligence and furthering intelligence, would you expect that, you know, Marines and SEALs and special forces are going to, when they apprehend someone on the battlefield, are going to have to read the Miranda warnings to make that legitimate? I mean, you have an inherent, wouldn't you recognize that there's an inherent conflict between the law enforcement model of interrogation and the interrogation for purposes of intelligence gathering and furthering prosecuting a war or conflict involving unarmed or unlawful combatants?
I think those are great questions. They really get at the heart of things. And if I didn't make this clear, let me make it clear now. First of all, let me take on the straw man of Miranda. As everybody in here knows, practices criminal law, Miranda doesn't apply until you're at a place where you're conducting interrogations and they've been they've been secured, they're in custody, and you're interrogating them. Miranda's not on the scene.
I'm a former prosecutor, Your Honor, or professor, and I would disagree because if you're asking the person a question, if
they're in custody. It's a question of whether
technically, that's the question. Are they in custody? Yeah, right. In custody, not necessarily at the station.
But in custody, but it's an interrogation. But leave that aside. I'm not saying that there are the fundamental proposition that you're making, which is that intelligence gathering is forward-looking, criminal prosecutions are backward-looking, to ascribe responsibility, to attach culpability for a past event. I recognize that distinction, and I recognize that that's the principal distinction between intelligence gathering and criminal prosecutions that I don't want to eliminate, first of all. Secondly, I also think that there is an intelligence gathering function that can continue to go on while you are engaging in criminal investigations. That happens in criminal prosecutions or in criminal investigations. Third, what I said was that criminal prosecutions in the military commission context can still take place as long as they are limited to their proper sphere. So we have them now, we should continue to have them. So where we have military operations, we ought to have military prosecutions. The concern I have is the idea that you would have military or some hybrid new form where there aren't military operations. So the idea that you could do what people call a snatch and grab from a guy who is in Indonesia because you suspect that he may not have even done it yet. He may be planning some action. And then we bring him back here and we put him, right, but it's not sufficient for it to be a criminal case yet. And that's the hypothetical. The hypothetical is, it's this guy. He hasn't committed a crime. He's identified as a person of interest to the government of the Philippines or Indonesia. They have intelligence information that they won't share with us in an open forum. He's planning something very, very bad. He wants to do something very bad, but he hasn't committed a crime yet. How do you incapacitate that guy?
But if you do the snatch and grab, what are you doing? You interrogate him. You
stand up and raise your voice on Twitter.
If you do the snatch and grab, then you get him because you've got intel, you've got signal intelligence, you picked him up on a phone conversation on Hotlink or something like that. You've got another a terrorist who's identified it by picture. You've got really good actionable intelligence. You snatch and grab him. I mean, then what?
No.
Then do you keep him indefinitely?
No.
Why not? I mean, he's going to go back and kill me.
Right.
Or us. Or anybody.
Because what you've just described, you've added pieces of information.
Right? I don't think that's good enough.
No. What I'm saying is, once you've got the information that you've just given me, you can prosecute him. And you ought to.
For what? Like you said, he hasn't committed a crime. Maybe he's conspiring. Maybe he's acquired some. But it's all amorphous. And if you do prosecute him, you're giving away the family jewels.
May I ask you how you would apply your question to a standard domestic issue? We know the recidivism rate of sex offenders is astronomical. Does it follow that we would keep sex offenders in prison forever?
There are now processes in place, Your Honor, for that. I mean, I think California and several other states have gone with this civil commitment. Where they do go through a process.
You can have civil commitment, but there has to be a showing that there's a very substantial probability.
And you bring
and
in
even then,
of,
people
you
are very
bring
skeptical
in a lot of experts to do that. So I'm saying, I think Mr. Margulis wants to just let them go once he's gathered the intelligence. I think you need to have a process in place.
May I support my good friend, Mr. Margulis, by saying this? There seems to be some misnomer that under international law, if we're engaged in an armed conflict, which I think we all agree, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and Afghanistan, and Iraq, that if you have an Al-Qaeda member, it happens to be in Indonesia or Yemen, but that person provided there's sufficient linkage, because I wouldn't say that every supervisor is a member of it. If you have an Al-Qaeda guy sitting in Indonesia, that person is as much an enemy combatant as the guy in Iraq and Afghanistan. Any more than during World War II, if you had a Wehrmacht officer happened to be, vacationing in Switzerland, if we grab him, or SS officer, we can treat him no differently. I mean, international law of war distinguishes between a state of armed conflict, which is certain intensity of violence, as ever said, and a state of no armed conflict. But I don't know of any proposition which says that if you are, picked up 500 miles away from the valley where the airstrikes are going on, that you're suddenly not a combatant. That would be silly. I mean, we have a global conflict. So the laws would apply, provided he's a member of.
Right.
If he has a Swiss grand, you know, he has an elderly Swiss grandmother, which has come up, unfortunately, in some foolish answers by certain DOJ lawyers, then you are not liable to be tried as an immigrant combatant. But that would be true whether you're in Afghanistan or in Indonesia.
But I want to make it clear, because, you know, you're asking exactly the right question. I want to make it clear that the United States is not powerless in this circumstance. One, the information you've given me indicates that we have sufficient information on him that we can continue to monitor him and use him as a source for intelligence, right? And surveil him in any way that is available to us. Human intelligence and signal intelligence. So that's why I said the information gathering process is not inconsistent with criminal prosecution. Second, as David said, of course that person can be picked up and held in connection with, you know, as an enemy combatant status. And then what happens to them afterwards is what we're talking about. And the third thing is, the fact is you probably can get enough information, if you don't have it already, to prosecute that guy in an Article 3 court.
I think that's a leap of faith. I personally think that's a leap of faith. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We have to allow other people who have questions. But those of you who have questions, stand up. Give me a sense of how many people want to ask questions. One, two. All right. Well, we'll manage. Go ahead.
Thank you. In objection to Professor Margulis' allegation that there's been a balanced discussion here and that all prosecutions in the Southern District of New York have been successful, which perhaps they have been, but I would allege that they've only been against patsies rather than the real instigators, which I submit are more likely Mossad agents and the Mossad-controlled faction of the CIA. I would like to accept the Honorable Moderator's invitation to stand up because I have some inside information. Okay. And I submit that, my question is this, because I know you want a question. The question is, how come there's been no discussion, at least in the first minute or two of each panelist's discussion, of the assumption that the so-called war on terror is real as distinct from unreal and legitimate as distinct from phony?
Just quickly, if anyone else wants to add, I think because I've taught folks that have been fighting in Afghanistan, fighting Al-Qaeda, and I've been over there and I've had folks that have died in combat against Al-Qaeda. So it's definitively a war in both Iraq right now and Afghanistan. I don't think any of my distinguished colleagues, including Neil, would dispute that. So I think up front we all agreed there was an armed conflict of some sort, a new type of armed conflict, but one that's going on.
Okay, well, I would like to pit my inside information, which comes from a former U.S. military and intelligence officer, who I will disclose privately, who claims, and I believe, that a U.S. military officer in Afghanistan shortly after 2001 had Osama in custody. He was promised three different airlifts to, you know, get him out of there, and each time the U.S. military failed to deliver those airlifts, he applied to my contact for an introduction to Colin Powell, which did take place. Colin Powell was convinced to approach the president with this matter, and the word from the president to both Colin Powell and the two military and intelligence officers was, mind your own business.
Look, there's no way you
it's would very difficult to test such propositions. Here in Chicago, of course, there have been many confirmed stories about the death of Jimmy Hoffa. But one has to be very careful about unconfirmed and, by definition, unconfirmable stories. We had another question here? Yeah, please. Could you raise your voice, please? We're competing with a jet plane.
Immediately above us.
Certainly. I think I'm coming from the opposite perspective of both of the last questions. I guess my question is directly for Mr. Szymanski, to perhaps engage more directly the assertion of our third speaker concerning the necessity of these hybrid courts. He referenced several examples. I think you can find even more. Our second speaker in particular probably say the most
a whole laundry list. Thanks. I think, you know, what you're asking basically is why the National Security Court when we have these other opportunities. My discussion was predominantly about folks outside extraterritorial capture, which I think was the mode that we put forward for the panel. So it was strictly limited to that, not getting into this civilian American citizen. Basically, it would be denial of some of their constitutional rights to go before, or at least a diminished expectation of constitutional protections within those, which would be a whole other gamut that I think Neil raised by raising that. But I think why we need this sort of an item is really a consciousness of kind of all the questions and the panelists have discussed. It is a war. It's an armed conflict, contrary to what a couple of folks' beliefs. But it's a different type of war, and I think we have to recognize that as much as the military commissions, as I think I stated, are lawful in a Geneva Convention, or if we're fighting China or another signatory to the Geneva Conventions, where reciprocity was the issue at hand. When you look at who we're fighting now, we have to be conscious that it's not a nation state. We don't have a nation state. We have an ideology, one that seeks to destroy Western civilization, and it's spread across 50 nation states. I think we have to be conscious. It becomes terribly difficult for us to detain and put folks in military commissions, right or wrong, when they're from Great Britain, or when they're from Australia, from otherwise allies of ours, and it creates problems for us in a variety of contexts, not the least of which is some human rights obligations that they're obliged to in their governments, in their own political survival in some cases, a la E.G. Tony Blair, and how we can move forward. And so I think the best way to do this is to create some sort of a court that would be at least more palatable to our international partners as well as our own domestic consumption.
And can I just jump in on it? Look, the fact that they're our allies, all the people who were prosecuted in the first embassy bombing case and the embassy bombing case, the first World Trade Center case, they were our allies. They were nationals of our allies. So what? So they come to this country and they commit a crime. Or they stay in some other country, but they orchestrate a crime. So what? They're a criminal. You prosecute them. And the one example that's always trotted out, and I don't mean, when I say trotted out, I shouldn't be glib. These are very serious, thoughtful people who are proposing things in a very serious, thoughtful way, and it deserves careful consideration. Not least of which is the Attorney General, who did a very good job, by the way, in the Ramzi Youssef trial. He presided over the first World Trade Center case. And one of the things that he points out, he says, look, it didn't work. I know, because I was there. And what he talks about is what David mentioned. He said, there was a witness list that had to be provided. And there was a witness list that the prosecution had to disclose, and it had to list unindicted co-conspirators. And one of the unindicted co-conspirators was Osama bin Laden. And 10 days later, that list was in his hand in Khartoum, in Sudan. Okay? And so he says, you see, the process doesn't work because information gets to him. That's the particularization. That's always what they talk about. All right. I want you to think about this. Is that disclosure, first of all, we don't know how it is he got that, because Andy McCarthy, the prosecutor, acknowledged that there were leaks by everybody. The FBI was also leaking information. But let's just accept that somehow a defendant got that information to him. This is after bin Laden had issued his fatwa. Do you think that the disclosure to bin Laden that he was a person of interest and maybe even had been indicted in the Southern District of New York is of any significance to him from an intelligence gathering? Of course he was a person of interest. That's what he wanted to be. It doesn't alter what he does. It's not a disclosure that diminishes our information gathering capacities or represents a diminution of our capacity to conduct prosecution, either in that case or in any other case. He's on a witness list. Of course he's on a witness list. Hell, he's been indicted as a co-conspirator in United States versus bin Laden, which is the embassy bombing case.
Final two comments. Our time has run, so these are it.
Very briefly on the aspect of engendering greater, level of camaraderie with our allies. I would be prepared if I genuinely believe that we can restore, I accept the proposition, very badly played cooperation. I would go down a certain path of review. I'm afraid that it's not possible. I'm afraid that the differences, very briefly, between us and much of the rest of the world far transcend the specific nomenclature, what we call something military commission, what we call something, a counterterrorism court. I can tell you because of disagreements over death penalty and various other things. unfortunately get called upon to go and do a foreign media. I guess I enjoy it in a way. Every time, every trial you can think about, including Ramzi Youssef, including Padilla, including Walker Lynn, gets slammed regularly. If we have a counterterrorism court limited to essentially a population of unlawful enemy combatants, and have disagreements about who are the unlawful enemy combatants and how tightly do you need to link yourself to an organization to not become a proverbial Swiss grandmother. It would never work because, unfortunately, much of the rest of the civilized world has given up on war, sort of a normative exercise. Very proud of themselves. And there are very few people left like us who do not. Not because it's a good thing to go and kill people. It's terrible and offends our 21st century sensibility. But there are a lot of bad people out there. So I honestly don't want anybody to believe that if we buried military commissioners, created a counterterrorism court, that would make Joseph and Neil happy. But it would resolve our problems with the Germans and the French and the Dutch. Because it ain't so, unfortunately.
Real quickly, the idea we're discussing, what we're talking about, is what to do with Guantanamo. Our leaders want to close it. And the options really are just, we can't close Guantanamo in terms of the military commissions process. That's what's been put forward. So the option is either, the real option is what to do, we put them into the civilian courts. I just want to remind everybody, if we're going to say we're going to close it, what are we going to do? Are we going to free them? Not a single candidate for office right now has mentioned what they're going to do. Everyone is criticizing, but not saying what they're going to do. So it's realistic and important that we have these discussions about a potential for a terrorist court, because if it does go into civilian courts, we have to think of things, about things like my colleague in the back was talking about the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment. Soldiers capturing computers inside in a safe house are not getting a search warrant when they're doing that in Yemen or in Afghanistan, and we could not bring them back. Witnesses, juries, the bleed over potentially to what we do hold here, which my other colleague said in the back about our own system, the potential for bleed over. We're going to, if we have some sort of these national terrorism courts, if we have something like that, if we have commissions, there's a sense that we're going to have some bleed over into our own normal prosecutions of drugs, the drug war, aliens, and we can stop them and look at the dangers associated with that sort of item, never mind the classified information that can be susceptible. So I think we have to think about, if we're going to close it, which is what is likely going to happen in some form or fashion, what do we do?
Well, our time has expired, but I want you to join me in thanking the panel for a wonderful discussion.